I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching the first season finale of New Order, broadcasting all around the world, including to nearly 1.5 billion on RT India. We on New Order trace how India and its allies sit at the center of a transformation in world history. As the Trump-Netanyahu war in West Asia rages on, with millions killed, wounded or displaced, the pressure is no longer confined to West Asia, though Saudi Arabia has reportedly floated a non-aggression pact with Iran for West Asia. Geopolitical shockwaves are reaching the heart of the multipolar world itself. This week, India hosted UAE, Chinese, Russian and Iranian, to name but a few, top officials at the BRICS foreign ministers meeting under its 2026 chairmanship. At the same time, Prime Minister Modi launched a major diplomatic tour across the UAE and Europe as Delhi attempts to balance energy security, trade stability, Western partnerships and global South leadership all at once. The timing could hardly be more sensitive. Iran is demanding stronger political backing from BRICS against the US and Israeli violations of the UN Charter. Trump and Netanyahu bombed hospitals, schools and power stations amidst an avowed intent to commit genocide against a civilization. The two Gulf GCC members, Saudi Arabia and where I am, the UAE, are trying to avoid direct confrontation. And looming in the background is self-proclaimed enemy of BRICS, President Trump, internationally last seen with a team of U.S. ruling oligarchs in Beijing. As wars expand, economic blocs harden, and major powers compete for influence across energy, trade, and security, can the global South still successfully navigate between rival systems? Or is the world moving towards a moment when neutrality itself becomes impossible? At the end of the show, we'll be joined by New Order's Zara Khan to answer questions from you, the viewers. With me now is one of the world's most influential voices in contemporary international relations. Scholar Professor Richard Sakwa has refused British totalitarian groupthink, dismissing the Russiagate hoax that tried to depict Trump as a Russian agent, let alone the reasons for the conflict in Ukraine. His most recent books include Frontline Ukraine, The Putin Paradox, and The Russo-Ukrainian War, Follies of Empire. Professor Richard Sakwa, welcome to New Order. After Iran, the war in Iran, the UAE and Iranian ministers meeting at the BRICS meeting in Delhi, let alone Trump in Beijing, do you think we are witnessing the death of a unipolar order in real time?
We definitely are. The unipolar order has been on its way out for quite a long time. But unfortunately, unipolarity has, in the United States, begun to give way to unilateralism, which isn't much better. So what we're witnessing is the twilight of that model of world order, which Russians love to call it the collective West. I call it the political West. The others call it the Atlantic West, the split between Western Europe and the United States. But that whole model of world order established after 1945 is now giving way to, yes, multipolarity, but an alternative model of world order. And multipolarity is only a symptom, so it's not actually a world order in itself. What this alternative order is a vision which is in conformity with the norms of the international system. By that I mean the United Nations, established also in 1945, international law, the whole system, the whole setup after 1945, which was challenged by this collective West, by this Atlantic West. But as this Atlantic West is losing power, it's going berserk, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, there's reasons for optimism, clearly, but there's in the dying embers of unipolarity. I mean, it's a strange question to ask, but how close are we to global war?
We've had a lot of discussions in Europe over the last few months, and the way that the Russo-Ukrainian war has become a Russo-European war in the last few months, and that many commentators would argue that we're in the thick of it. But clearly, we're only in the foothills. Fortunately, it's not entirely kinetic. Of course, the European powers are supporting Ukraine in its drone and other attacks, and it's, of course, militarizing itself and is trying to warn of a coming war with Russia. But the language is in terms of, it's like the war fever in 1914. It's a very frightening sort of atmosphere at this time. And indeed, it's fortunate, of course, that European war talk is balanced by more sensible talk in most of the rest of the global South.
I mean, can you understand, though, that in Western Europe, they're losing the global South? I mean, there's no real talk about Western Europe apart from, I suppose, as a target market for the BRICS countries that were meeting in Delhi, the foreign ministers that were meeting in Delhi. And in that context, then Western Europe only has its war with Russia as a means to exist militarily. That's how they seem to define themselves.
And of course, if it started backing off and if it actually began to talk to Russia, as some leaders have suggested earlier, of course, Viktor Orban, who's no longer in power in Hungary, Bart De Wever in Belgium, has said, well, hang on, it may be sensible to talk to the Russians. The astonishing thing is that in just a couple of months, well, in just about a month, this war, the Russo-Ukrainian war, will be longer than the First World War. But even by 1916, the second, third year of the First World War, people were saying, look, we need to talk to the Germans. The Germans put forwards peace proposals and so on. It's this stubborn, refusal to engage in diplomacy is one thing which marginalizes the European Union and the European leadership more widely.
And they're pouring billions of dollars worth of weapons into the Zelensky regime, and simultaneously they are introducing more and more sanctions packages on Russia. Do you think another notable aspect is the death of the NATO sanctions? I mean, famously, it's 38 million, The Lancet said, have been killed by US sanctions between 1970 and 2021. The world of sanctions by NATO countries is also over.
Well, unfortunately, it's not over. The European Union has just adopted its 20th package, and it's now working on its 21st. They're running out of things to sanction, of course, because it's now, as it were, the rubble is bouncing in sanctions terms. But nevertheless, they're digging their heels in. The United States, of course, under Trump, has made, and in particular after the Anchorage meeting in Alaska in August 2025, The Russians love to talk about the spirit of Anchorage, but this hasn't really been much in evidence, especially last autumn when Trump imposed severe sanctions on Russian oil exports, which of course affected India deeply. And of course, it had 25% extra tariffs imposed on it for continuing its import of Russian oil. Of course, after the Iran war, they've lifted these sanctions, but still, it was a warning sign of a power which simply does not know. It's addicted to sanctions, and I'm afraid it's going to be a very hard process to let them kick that bad habit, that addiction.
But my point was, they don't really care. You know, as the Russian, Chinese, Indian foreign ministers are meeting, and South African and Brazilian, in Delhi, they don't really appear to care that much anymore about the impact of tariffs or sanctions. I mean, obviously, in the Trump Xi Jinping meeting, Xi Jinping has been shrugging off threats of tariffs.
And indeed, refusing to accept the secondary sanctions on oil companies in China that continue to import Russian oil or and any other Iranian oil in particular. So indeed, China is big enough to withstand it. India has been in a more difficult position because of its huge dependency on, you know, over, I think 78% of India's oil is imported, and in particular from the Gulf. So, but China is big enough to withstand it. Other countries can't. Russia, of course, is also big enough to be the most sanctioned country in the world and still to survive, but is taking a very heavy toll.
I mean, do you think India has become one of the clearest examples of what a successful multipolar power looks like? It maintains relations, very close relations with Iran, close relations with Russia, and of course, close relations with the United States and China.
Yeah. This is why I'm a bit sceptical about using the word multipolarity. Yes, it's an important feature, but we have to be very careful how to define it. I personally believe that in terms of the Charter International System, that is the United Nations, that we've seen the decolonization in the post-war years. And this system has now matured. India became independent, obviously, in 1947. But even before that, it was made a founder member of the United Nations. Today, we have 193 states in the world. These states have matured. The post-colonial states have matured. None of them are willing to be bossed around by the traditional hegemon. So in other words, in normative terms, that is, in ideological terms, we have 193 poles. Of course, some are bigger, some are smaller. But even the middle powers, as Carney put it, the Canadian Prime Minister at the Davos meeting, the middle powers now have to step up. We're talking about Brazil, we're talking about South Africa, we're talking about Nigeria, the Philippines, Indonesia, many other countries. All of these countries now playing in them, and Saudi Arabia, so many. So in other words, the traditional US definition of a pole, which is the whole panoply of power, simply doesn't hold. So what we're talking about is as the great scholar Amitav Acharya calls it, a multiplex world with so many different actors, states. Of course, major corporations today act as quasi-state organizations. There's also international international organizations like the United Nations itself, which of course stands above them all in normative terms. So the world is more complex. There are, as I say, the system has matured. And there's only one thing which has not matured, and that is the Western arrogance or belief that it has some sort of God-given right to be hegemonic, to be dominant. And today, even the United States to be dominant even over its former allies in the Atlantic power system.
Yeah, I'm not sure about your emphasis on the UN, though. I mean, let alone that someone called Annalena Baerbock, I think she lied on her CV, didn't she? She's become the president of the UN General Assembly. Yes. But obviously the UN has come under increased scrutiny after its inability to appear to do anything during the Gaza genocide. Yeah. Surely the UN, without India on the Security Council, some might say, or Saudi Arabia on it.
I'm glad you raised that. It's the biggest crisis. Today, we're seeing a crisis of the political West, the collective West, with the Trumpian disruption, let's call it that. But at the same time, the United Nations is, as you absolutely rightly point out, in its most desperate stage since 1945. The response to that is, yes, indeed, they foisted Annalena Baerbock, this militant former German foreign minister, Werner Rosshofer.
Green Party.
But that has been, and the Green Party, yeah. Well, some people even in Germany, I heard her saying that she's been a magnificent example of a feminist foreign policy. Well, if that's a feminist foreign policy, then, well, I think we could do without it. But the thing is to double down to support the UN, not to dismiss it, is my view. And of course, India should be, absolutely essentially a permanent member. So the crisis of this, of the United Nations today, may be an opportunity to reset some elements, including, of course, bringing Brazil, India, some other countries, African, obviously, to become permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. I can understand some Indian sentiments because we've been talking about it for so many years and it hasn't happened.
Professor?
There's a lot of disappointment.
Professor, we'll continue after the break. Keep watching New Order. You're watching New Order. Professor Richard Sakwa, you were talking about how the UN should be reformed. Trump, in fairness, seems to understand the significance of why different transnational institutions need to be reformed. Do you think it's important for Trump to dissolve NATO if he's going to be part of the, or if the United States is going to be part of this new, I don't know whether I should say multipolar after what you were saying in part one, but multinodal world?
And it would be logical, because what the United States has always done is ensured to defend its own sovereignty. Even when it established the Atlantic system, the political West, the collective West, it always retained its autonomy. And one of the conditions for to joining the United Nations, as opposed to the League of Nations in 1919, was the veto power in the Security Council. And of course, Trump earlier this year left 66 international organizations, half of them UN or agencies, including important ones like the World Health Organization. No. So the United States is going it alone. It is the most powerful country in the world. It still has a booming economy, despite increased petrol prices and so on, and rising inflation. It's a booming economy. 2.7% growth this year. Obviously, not as much as India, which is the world's fastest growing economy, but it's doing very well for a mature economy. And it says it doesn't need these allies. It doesn't need the what Joseph Nye called soft power. It doesn't need anyone, but it respects power. And that's why when Trump talks with Xi Jinping, they talk as equals, because China is not going to be pushed about. And of course, India has been much buffeted over the last year or so, given the sanctions, given the threats, because clearly over the last year or two, India had sought to rebuild the relationship with Washington. But the events of the last year have made this perhaps the most difficult time in U.S.-Indian relations over the last three decades, even, one could say.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to be the fastest growing economy by the end of this year, as there has been so much turbulence that has been catalyzed by the war in West Asia, clearly. And it's interesting that there was less of the weaponizing of human rights in the run-up to the Trump-Xi meeting in Beijing. I mean, that traditionally has been a means and a way of trying to belittle BRICS nations and the global South in Western Europe, I suppose, specifically. In Britain, in fact, in Parliament, it was only a couple of months ago that people were talking about the fact that India had no freedom of expression. Do you think we'll continue to see that weaponization of human rights as much? And I suppose I kind of ask it in the context of you and what happened to you in Heathrow Airport on the 13th of June, I understand, 2025. Freedom of expression is a value for Western Europe.
It's a crucial value. It's for all peoples, one has to say. This isn't a privilege, something just for the mature Western powers. But it has to be understood in context. It has to be understood as a evolutionary process. And of course, as you say, the human rights has been too often instrumentalized. And so you have this systemic double standards. You use it as a weapon against opponents and you give a free pass to your friends. But, I'm a rather old-fashioned person and do believe, and this is why at the core of the BRICS Charter and its documentation is precisely this appeal to the UN Charter, which of course also maintains the whole stack of elements of human dignity. And of course, in later years, including social rights and so on, these things are fundamentally important, but they become degraded when they become an instrument of geopolitical competition and contestation.
So what did happen to you in Heathrow?
Oh, yeah. So I was detained. They were waiting for me as I came off the plane.
What did you do, Professor Sackwise? I started this interview off by saying you were a scholar renowned all around the world for your work on international relations. What possibly could you have done?
Well, it's It's interesting, this. The detention is under the 2019 Counterterrorism Act, and they're allowed to hold you for up to 6 hours without charge. And it was a peculiar quirk of this, or feature of this law, is that if you say no comment and refuse to answer a question, it is taken as an indication of guilt. So they can immediately arrest you if you say no comment or refuse to answer a question. In other words, this goes against the fundamental principles of British common law, where you assume to be innocent, presumed to be innocent, rather than guilty, until proven guilty. It's an astonishing thing. So there were 4 hours of questioning, which tried to... It was a fishing expedition. And, of course, I have nothing to hide. My views are open out there. I'm very willing to debate with anyone. I mean, even, by the way, coming on this TV show carries a certain element of jeopardy. Let me put it this way. But, you know, I'm not going to be intimidated. But if... anybody else asks me to speak?
They stopped you because of what? Your differing perspective on intellectual debate currently raging in global international relations circles?
It was never specified. It was never specified. And fortunately, maybe not after this discussion, but fortunately, the case has gone quiet. I've also got some very good lawyers involved in the case, and they've been excellent.
I mean, why I draw attention to it is there's such vibrant debate going on amongst Shanghai Cooperation Organization, member states, officials, scholars, academics, and in BRICS countries about what this future world is rearranging into. Whereas then you hear about what you just said. I mean, is there a groupthink going on in Western Europe?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen many cases on the continent, the famous case of the Swiss scholar Jacques Bo, who's been stuck in Belgium for the last few months. Yes, there is. And of course, Starmerism is the most vivid expression of closing down of debate. We already saw the way he came to power in instrumentalizing various charges against Corbyn. And of course, he was the one who said that to be opposed to NATO membership is incompatible with Labour Party membership. Now, this is an astonishing phrase because the Labour Party was always a broad church. It's got
the British Labour Party.
The British Labour Party, yes. It was a movement. And of course, the peace movement has been an integral part of it. And of course, it's now been chased out of the Labour Party. So yes, there is a closing of the West European mind. And it's very frightening. And it's closed on positions of permanent war, militarism, remilitarization, and of course, a very profound Russophobia, which you could look at its historical context, but in my view, it's been fed by this Atlantic power system since 1945, with the first Cold War, and now what we could call a second Cold War.
I mean, if these Russophobic threats against Global South countries don't seem to have any traction. Modi didn't seem to care about what he's being told to act, how he's supposed to act with Putin. He always talks about his warmth with Vladimir Putin. If the threat of tariffs couldn't prevent India from going to the Tianjin Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, what are these powers going to do? What is Washington, how is it going to retaliate if none of its threats seem to spur any kind of action that they desire?
In fact, quite the opposite. These actions of the US and the West European powers are treated with contempt, increasingly with contempt, amongst great swathes of the global South. This sort of irresponsible bullying, this sort of attempt to impose endless sanctions, and of course, secondary sanctions are totally irresponsible. And more than that, by the way, illegal, because only the United Nations has the right, the Security Council, to impose multilateral sanctions. So all of this, they say it's in defense of international law, but the very act in trying to defend the international law in this way is an undermining and repudiation of international law. It's a classic case of double standards defeating the norm which they're meant to be upholding, like the anti-disinformation campaigns, which in themselves are a form of disinformation.
Professor Richard Sakwa, thank you.
Thank you.
And now, Zara Khan, New Order's Zara Khan is here for the season finale of New Order. Richard Sakwa, Professor Richard Sakwa was stopped at Heathrow Airport in London under terrorism.
I can't believe
suspicion.
That in the big year of 2026, we're still talking about people not having the freedom of expression and speech.
You're going to go to London on holiday?
I don't think it's on my list anymore after hearing that story.
Give me some questions from the viewers.
And one of them, I think you might recognize them because they've written to us before, June RTCB, who's asked, how can the world stop the US-Israel from the mass killings?
I mean, that's obviously the question of our times. Every person should be asking that themselves. I think you can't stop Israel from the killing. 93%, I think, in a recent poll supported, say, the bombing of Tehran. So who knows what they say about Gaza and southern Lebanon. What about the United States? I don't think you can necessarily stop. But I tell you, the countries that are complicit, arguably, in the killing, Germany, 31% of Israeli weaponry coming from them. Britain supplied the F-35 components with which Israel uses its warplanes to destroy. Turkey, Ceyhan Port, involved in the transit of oil. France, BNP Paribas, the primary dealer in the bond market. Italy continued to export throughout the Gaza genocide. Holland, parts warehouses. South Africa, a BRICS country, Israel's top coal supplier. Perhaps people in those countries could do something.
I mean, this was just an assumption that maybe June and I had the same thought that when they asked how can the world, it meant things like blocks like BRICS, like you've mentioned South Africa. But interesting to see that they might be complicit. Om has asked, what specific alternative security architectures or regional alliances should India prioritize to protect its maritime interests in the Indian Ocean if it exits the Quad? And I think that's something to do with what you said last week.
The Quad. Yeah. Oh, right, because I was saying that India should leave the Quad. There are loads of them. But I suppose they're not so military. The Quad is about military ties of India with the United States. I think it could expand on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that it joined in 2017. Obviously, there's BRICS. I'm not saying the New Development Bank can be militarized so much. North-South Transit Corridor between India, Russia, and Iran could be strengthened in some way. But I think the Primakov, he had a meeting in New York in 2002, the RIC, Russia, India, China, that should be perhaps resurrected. They met, you know, 18 times by 2019 and somehow it was dissolved. So maybe the RIC should be the new Quad. How about that?
I mean, Quad, I think, would require four members, but I see you've tried to sneak it in just as the season is ending. But thank you so much for answering all of those questions.
See you in a couple of weeks. Thanks, Zara. That's it from me, Afshin Ratansi, on New Order's season finale. Remember to follow us on social media. And here's a question for you. How does India and the Global South deal with the threat of Western Europe's war fever against Russia? Send us your answer on @NewOrder_TV. We'll be back on Sunday, June the 7th. Join us for the next season as we continue to track shifting global power and where India sits in this new order.